Accession number 30635, Mr. Doug Bone, Rule 7. Now, we're talking about, you know, the conditions. What about latrines? I mean, I'm not sure how formal a latrine you could have, you know, but did they put together something for you, a pole or something?
Well, yeah, you dug yourself a hole, a squadron hole. You had a squadron latrine, and you had a straining pole.
So it's just a pole?
Well, yeah, basically.
Over a pit?
Yeah.
And how often were they moved or filled in or burnt or whatever they did to them?
Well, they get filled in. Every time you moved practically every day. The whole squadron would move somewhere along the line. If it was only down the road, another 20 mile. And the first thing you did was dig your latrine and you dig a tin. You dig a hole where all your waste food, tins and everything were put.
So you didn't just throw tins at waste food?
Oh, God, no, you didn't throw it away. You buried it. You made sure it was hygienically disposed of. Well, yeah, that's one of the bases of military life, isn't it? It's hygiene. It's a pity the hospitals today didn't use it.
Now, any problems with lice or any thing like that?
No, I can't recall any problem like that.
And any problems with creepy crawlies of the local sort, you know, when you were going through the jungly part, or not? Well, it's not a jungle, is it? But you know what I mean.
No, there's no
spiders
jungle.
Or snakes or anything that you didn't like.
I can't really recall any, no.
So what happens next? You're in the valley riverbed area, you know, of the Harn. So what's the next thing you remember happening?
We then drove all the we eventually finished up in the outskirts of Pusan. And
so you were now being pulled out.
We were now being pulled out. And the Chinese were rushing down behind us. So we parked all the tanks in one big heap. And I think from memory, there was one member of each crew left behind. And the rest of us were then evacuated to Japan. And this was the only time that I was separated from Mel Howell in our army service. I went to Japan and he stayed with the squadron.
Now, how did you get to Japan? Was it by air or was it by sea?
By sea. It wasn't very far.
Do you remember anything about the trip?
Not really, no.
So where were you in Japan?
At Kure.
Now, when was this? Would this be still January or are we moving
No,
on?
No, no. This was spring 19...
So, April-y?
No, before April, because
so
we were back again, ready for the Gloucester battle, which was 21st of April.
So, probably March.
March, yeah.
Because February's winter. February's winter, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we're put roundabout. What were you doing at Curie? Well, the tanks were left behind, obviously.
The tanks were left behind. We were just sitting there in limbo.
And anything happening at all? Or?
There was, in Curie itself, it was an American bearing in mind that the Japanese had, Americans had a force of occupation in Japan at that stage. And it was one of their ports where all their stores used to come into. There was a good NAFI PX center there and a good club, which we were
use. Now, tell me about these US facilities, because, I mean, what was in, for instance, the PX stores? What were they like?
Well, they were like, you could liken a PX store to a supermarket.
That big, as opposed to a British...
Well, as opposed to a British NAFI club, yeah, they were big.
So what would they sell? I mean...
Well, they'd sell anything. On the day, you know. Today, obviously, PX will sell you a motor car, but those days you didn't buy one.
So it wasn't just food and booze.
No,
and
it was
bags.
Everything.
It was.
Yeah.
And what about their NAFI club? Their, you know.
Well, this PX is their NAFI center, isn't it? Basically.
Right. Yeah.
And we there was whether it was formed by us or whether we'd taken it over from the Americans, but we had our own NAFI club in Cure.
And what was that like?
Well, it was everything there that you wanted. It was basic. You got a drink, you got some food, and you met. The Navy used it quite a lot because there was quite a contingent of naval ships floating around Korea. In fact, I met someone there who I went to school with in Queen Mary School in Basingstoke. He joined the Navy. I've tried and tried and tried to find him, but I don't know. I know his intention when we were at school was that he was going to immigrate to Australia. But whether he immigrated to Australia and then joined the Australian Navy or not, I shall never know. But he walked up to me and said, "Hello, Doug." That you know, it comes out of the blue, that does. That sort of thing.
So how long were you there? Till April? Just a month or so? Or not even that?
Not even that.
So then what?
We then went back and remobilised our tanks again. And we had started to push the Chinamen back again.
Now what do you remember? So you picked your tanks up. You were back with B Squadron.
B Squadron.
And what's happening? What's the next thing that happens, if you see what I mean? Do you advance on the ground or on the or you just put on a train to move forward?
No, I think from memory, we drove north. We finished up. One place I remember finishing up was the airport for Seoul was at a place called Kimpo. And we were there, and it was near Incheon, which was the northernmost port that was always open to Korea.
Not frozen up.
It was never no. That was a bit farther up. It was always frozen, or frozen in the winter, obviously.
Now, what do you remember about Kimpo, the advance there?
Well, it was a vast area, and there was a big disused scrapyard, for want of a better word, where the Americans dumped all their vehicles. And by this time, all us fitters were then issued. Our colonel of the day said that we couldn't go into action with Bren gun carriers. The amount of tools and equipment we had to carry was the Bren gun was inadequate to carry it. So he went to MacArthur. And MacArthur issued us with all brand new half tracks.
What make?
Well, some were white, some were international. Well, there were the two manufacturers of the half track.
And which did you have?
I had an international. Mine was an international.
That was his name. So it was an international half track.
Yeah, it was international. Yeah, made by International Harvester Company.
Now, what did you think of that?
Well,
as a half track.
Oh, it was a fantastic vehicle, and it was equipped. It had so much equipment on it, and every one of these were brand new. And they had two machine guns, a 5.0 Browning on one end, and a 3.0. I don't know whether that was made by Browning or not, but that used to fit on the back end. And it had all its wireless equipment. The wireless equipment was no good to us because we weren't using the same network. It had an axe, and it had a saw, and it had everything.
And how many fitters would it carry? Or would
it would carry. There was about four of us, and all our kit. And I think from memory, in our fitters troop, we had, I don't know, two or three.
Are these half tracks?
Bearing in mind the rest of us, by then, had they, we used to use them virtually for carrying the kit, because by this time we'd pinched all our jeeps, so we had the jeeps as well. My time scale is a little bit out with this, because
I know what you mean. So you got this international half track and you really liked it, so
yeah.
So then what?
And I drove that from one end of Korea to the other, and I think I did 18,000 miles in a year with it.
And was it mechanically reliable? I mean,
yes, it was mechanically reliable. And you had the advantage of the tracks were made of rubber, but they wore, obviously. And you just pulled into the nearest American depot and said, "Can I have a set of tracks?" And they'd say, "Yeah, but go and get a cup of coffee."
And they'd do it for you.
They'd put the tracks on for you. Oh, yeah, it was good.
So what happens next, for you, as far as you're concerned? You're going to Kimpo.
Yeah. Yeah, and we eventually were then going back north. And we pushed the Chinaman back that far. And we were then on the... the name of the river.
Imjin.
On the Imjin.
This is a Kuang San area. That's where the glossers were and everything else is.
Yeah.
So is that where you moved
we
to?
We got back to the Imjin River. We were leaguered up in a place called Mistletoe, which obviously got named Mistletoe Orchard. It was a big orchard of apple trees. And
now, can you explain, because we haven't really done this, what is a leaguer? You know, because it's what tanks do. They leaguer up.
Now,
can you explain for them who might not know what it is?
It's an area where a secure area where a squadron or regiment, basically a squadron of tanks, can rest up but protect themselves. You formed a leaguer basically in a circle, and all your guns obviously were pointing outwards, so you were covered in a 365 degree area, and the rest of the men in the thin skin vehicles were all in the middle.
And is this where you'd replenish ammunition?
This is where you replenish ammunition, fuel and food and what have you. And if you were in a static position, you would come back to that area every night. In other words, you could build your... You got to the stage when you were clever enough to build your living accommodation separate from your tank. So you could drive your tank away in the morning, your tent would be stood there, you could go out, and which we did. We used to go across the...
I'll come back to that. So you built your own accommodation. I mean, what would you build? Or would it just be a tent?
It would be a tent with a tarpaulin and...
Not dug in then?
No. We never dug ourselves in.
So that was a lay. And that's where you, the fitters, would be.
We had our own, yes. We had two half tracks, and we would park one side, one there, and build a bit in the middle. Sheeted over.
Now, would you go out with the tanks when they went out, or would you stay where you were at the Liga?
No, we would go to the start point. Now, assuming we were in the Liga at this side of the Imjin River, and we do a patrol the other side of the north side of
Well, take me through a patrol then, because you started and I cut you off. What would a typical patrol be like?
A typical patrol would be you would cross the river at first light in the morning.
Now, how did you get, could you drive across the
yep,
river?
Yeah, you could drive.
You didn't have to go on a bridge.
You could ford the MGM River where we were, at Gloucester Crossing.
Now, what was... So that was the ford?
Yep. And you would drive... It was basically a patrol, the same as the infantrymen did.
So you'd go across the river. Would you take your half track with you?
Yep, we'd go across the river. So as we were the right side of the river, if anything went wrong, we didn't have to, you know, you didn't have to ford the river to get to the breakdown or whatever. You were there. And the tanks would go off, and they would...
Now, you'd stop at the start
point. We would stop at the start point, and you were in radio control, or a radio communication with them. And the tanks would go X number of miles up the valley, looking for the enemy.
And would they find them?
Very rarely. I'm going back now, and this went on. You would, whilst you were on patrol, you would put a dozen infantrymen on the back of the tank with their rifles and what have you, and you'd take them with you. And when you got to somewhere of a bit of interest where there might have been a few Chinamen, the infantrymen would then go and have a look and see if they were there.
So you'd have a section with you?
A section.
And that gave you a bit more move.
Yeah.
Because I presume they'd move about in terrain where you couldn't.
That's right. Yeah. They were there also to protect you if anything did happen. Because the tank's pretty vulnerable when you stop and think about it on its own.
And what about the terrain, the other side of the MGM? How suitable was that for tank? Because my impression from seeing photographs was it isn't at all.
It isn't at all. It wasn't. I suppose over a period of time, you made your own tracks and you stuck to those tracks. Because this used to go on perhaps twice a week, you would do a patrol. And we used to spend a month in... No, it wasn't a month. Perhaps a fortnight. You were then deemed to be in action for a fortnight. In other words, you were up there supporting the infantry. All round the... Where we were in Mistletoe Orchard was the hills of Camaxan, where the Gloucesters were cut off. The Gloucesters were on the hills, the Northumberland Fusiliers were on the hills, the Ulster Rifles, bless them. The Belgians, I took a troop of tanks, not when I say I, it took them. I went with them. A troop of tanks was attached to the Belgian artillery, infantry regiment.
And what's your...
And I went with them with two vehicle mechanics, an electrician, a gunfitter, and a wireless mechanic. And that was the complement that looked after those four tanks. One of those tanks was commanded by Barry Summerfield.
And what do you remember of your time with the Belgians?
Well, we didn't see much of them, but we were out on our own. We were near...
So you were in support of them?
We were in support of the Belgians.
Rather than with them?
Yeah. And we had to drive... The rest of the squadron was in Mistletoe Orchard, and the Belgians were here. And we used to drive from there to there, along the front of the Imjim River. And the Chinamen were the other side, and they'd take a pop at you with a mortar. And you had to be pretty quick.
What was it like being under Chinese mortar fire?
Well, it's pretty... pretty scary. I think I've only ever experienced twice, but it certainly did makes you duck a bit quick. And
did you get nervous? I mean, how nervous were you? I mean, because different people are
different. Oh, yeah, well, you're bound to.
Did it worry you much?
I don't think you had time to worry about it. I don't think worries. You can't worry about it.
Get nervy or edgy.
You can't worry about anything that you haven't got control over, can you? Or you shouldn't worry about anything you haven't got control over. And that goes from us sat here now.
So, to you, you were nervous when it happened, but it wasn't something you worried about the rest of the time.
That was close, didn't you? An hour afterwards.
Now, anything about that? So, what happened during the actual Gloucester? I'm just wondering where you were and what.
We were in support of the Gloucesters right up until the 20th of April, and we went on a reconnaissance up the valley, over the Imjim, in other words, and up the valley, as I've described there on a patrol.
Were you with them that day or not?
I was the other side of the river, and they went, I think from memory, they went nearly 20 miles north into the Chinese territory and didn't see a soul. When we came, the object was that when we came back, C Squadron had moved into Mistletoe Orchard, so we vacated the position. We'd taken all our tents down and everything, and we'd stowed it all. We knew what was happening. When we came back over the river, we just drove through C Squadron, and we were supposedly going back to Seoul to rest. And we left C Squadron there, and that night was the night that the Chinamen came.
That's the night of the
21st of April. 21st and 22nd, wasn't it?
All right, yeah.
Well, it spanned over 3 days, actually, wasn't it? And that was the night that they got overrun.
And we
missed it by 12 hours.
And you weren't recalled?
Yeah. We weren't recalled until after the event. There was no point because the tanks couldn't get there. And C Squadron was commanded by Major Huth. And it was he that got, I don't know when he got the DSO aspect for it.
So you missed that.
And I missed it by, B Squadron missed it by 12 hours, basically. And then when, after it all died down, C Squadron was, they'd lost 5 tanks that night. And they pulled out, and we went back again then, and took over the position again. And that's when we recovered. Well, we tried to recover some of the tanks that they had lost.
Now, what do you remember of that?
Well, there was 5 we lost that night. One was commanded by a Sergeant Holberton, who got taken prisoner. His tank went over the hill. You've seen a photograph of it many times, I'm sure. And the gun was pointing forward, and it dove straight in the ground. And it was in the ground. The barrel was in the ground, 6 foot.
And could you get it out?
No, we didn't get it out. They had a load of wogs came there and dug the barrel out. And of course, as they dug, so the recoil pushed the barrel farther and farther down, didn't it? It went in the ground 6 foot after it had recoiled, and the rest of it was in the turret. So they eventually got it out, but they had a lot of digging to do to get it out. The tank that was next to...
And the crew had been captured.
I can't say whether all the crew had been captured, but the commander, Sergeant Holberton, certainly was.
And what about the others that you tried to get back?
Another tank next to it, only a matter of yards away, had gone off the road and thrown a track. They had to get, they got carried out on the back of another tank, and a very good friend of mine was the gunner. He was a trooper on that tank. He was the gunner. He finished up a major. He stayed in and became a major. You've heard of it. Oh, Slim Summerfield has spoken about it, you know, I feel sure, Bob Smith. In total, there was 5 tanks lost altogether. 2 farther down that were on their side and burnt out. Don't know what happened to the crew of them. But
you didn't have to try and get them back, I presume?
Well, no, they were a hopeless case, really. Some of them, they were eventually retrieved.
But not for reuse?
Not for reuse. I think one was reused, but they took the turret off it, and that's another story. I'll come later, that one.
So, what happens next then? That's quite a job, I should imagine, working on those tanks, you know, the ones you were trying to recover.
Well, yes. Recovery is not quite possibly the right word to use, but one of the tanks that was I was talking about, Bob Smith in particular, was tank. Someone in one of the design forts of the Centurion was that it had a massive oil cooler that went across, that was folded down and was a cooling facility for the engine lubrication. And to service the engine, you lifted the armoured decking up and traversed the turret, and between 2 stowage bins there was about that much gap,
and 18 inches,
and the oil cooler was across the engine like that. And to service the engine, you lifted the oil cooler and you put the tank and you led it up against the turret between the 2 stowage bins. Now, this was all right. The driver was then sat down there doing whatever he had to do. And somebody got in the turret and flicked the switch, and the turret turned and chewed the oil cooler on half, didn't it? This was not only once, but many times that it happened, can assure you. And we had just got back to Mistletoe Orchard when somebody did this, and the thing was completely immobilized, you can appreciate, with no oil cooler. So they said, well, there's one on that tank down the road, let's go down and pinch that. We had been previously told not to go anywhere near them because the possibility of them being booby-trapped. But that didn't worry us, so we went down there and took the thing off. And as it so happened, along came a reporter from the Stars and Stripes military paper. And he said, God, there's 2 Englishmen there. We'll take their photo. So he took my photograph, and he took another man's photograph on top of the tank with the barrel dug in the ground. And of course he wanted to know who we were, and like fools we told him, not knowing who he was at that stage or what was happening. So a copy of that photo of that newspaper then arrived on the colonel's desk, and there was 2 of his troopers, or Lance Corporals, I think we both were then, blatantly disobeying his order not to tamper with the tanks. So we got called up in front of him, and he gave us a dressing down. So we told him why we were doing it, and he did accept it in the finish, but